Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. We celebrate Earth Day this week, and to mark the event, we'll be speaking with Roderick Nash about his influential book, Wilderness and the American Mind. We'll also hear from historian Nancy Unger on just how accurately history is represented on television, in particular, in PBS's recently televised documentary on Woodrow Wilson. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On April 28, 1947, a six-man expedition aboard a primitive wooden raft known as the Kon-Tiki embarked on a 101-day, 5,000-mile transoceanic journey from Peru to Polynesia. Norwegian ethnologist and adventurer Thor Heyerdahl and five companions set out on a voyage that would take them to the islands east of Tahiti and demonstrate to the world the possibility that ancient people from the Americas may have colonized Polynesia. Constructing a primitive vessel out of materials akin to those available to ancient American peoples, Heyerdahl and his crew remained faithful to the spiritual tenor of ancient American times by naming their vessel after a legendary Incan god. Their use of centuries-old technology made Heyerdahl and his companions' accomplishment all the more astounding, but their feat ultimately failed to convince most anthropologists of the soundness of their theory that Polynesians originated in South America. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, survivors of the American firebombings of Tokyo that took place 57 years ago, during World War II, have opened a museum in Tokyo commemorating the victims. Mostly neglected in Japanese histories, the dropping of tons of napalm-filled bombs on Tokyo flattened over 16 square miles of the city and killed an estimated 100,000 people. Nevertheless, it has passed almost unnoticed, while the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have become central symbols of the World War II legacy. Gavin Menzies, a retired British submarine commander and an amateur historian, has challenged accepted history concerning the accomplishments of Christopher Columbus and Ferdinand Magellan. Menzies theorizes that the Chinese, the world's greatest naval power in the early 15th century, beat Columbus to America by 72 years and circumnavigated the globe well before Magellan did so in 1519. Drawing upon evidence from pre-Columbian Chinese maps, remains of shipwrecks in Australia and the Caribbean, and ancient Chinese artifacts found far from home, Menzies concludes that a Chinese fleet may have reached the coast of Baja California in 1421 and explored the coast of Africa, South America, and Australia before making its way home across the Pacific. This is Talking History. It began as a dissertation over 40 years ago and became one of the most influential history books of our time, Wilderness and the American Mind. Its author, Roderick Nash, joins us this week with Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
Wilderness and the American Mind by Roderick Nash is that rare book of history that has also shaped history. Environmental history is now a thriving field, but when Wilderness and the American Mind appeared in 1967, the field did not exist. It has been described as a book that changed the world and as the book of Genesis for environmentalists. A survey of the most important environmental books of all time has ranked Wilderness and the American Mind just behind Henry David Thoreau's Walden. It's a pleasure to have the author with us today. Professor Nash, welcome.
Thank you very much, Fred. Nice to be talking with you.
Now, you've described Wilderness and the American Mind as a good book, but also a lucky one. In what sense is luck an important part of its success?
As I look back now, I realized that I chose a topic to write about at a time when it was becoming extremely important in American culture. I was lucky. I picked a subject that 50 years before might not have attracted much attention, and now there are many people writing in the field. But I just happened to be right there at the beginning of environmental history, the first person to write a book about wilderness, and wilderness was becoming hugely important in American culture in the 1960s. Just think of this, the Wilderness Act of 1964 was passed the same year that I completed that dissertation with Merle Curti at the University of Wisconsin.
I wonder what kind of book you thought you were writing at the time. You've mentioned that your advisor, Merle Curti, wasn't taken with the idea, at least at first. Did you see the book, the dissertation first, as a more or less traditional intellectual history on a non-traditional subject, or were you conscious of writing something new?
Well, I came to Professor Curti and I said I thought I'd like to write about wilderness. And I recall him looking at me. He was a very gentle man, a Pulitzer Prize winner. And he said, you know, perhaps you're in the wrong department. Maybe you should go over to the geologists or the biologists. He thought I literally wanted to write about wilderness and what you might call ecology. And I said, well, sir, what I really have in mind is the concept of wilderness as a state of mind, that wilderness has really more to do with the geography of the mind than it does with the geography of the land. And then I think one could write a history of the changing idea of wilderness over time and our attitudes toward it and the value wilderness had in various cultures over time. And that interested him. So God bless him, he let me do what I call the big book. He let me write a dissertation on the big subject, which is not usual. As you know, most people are told by their mentors to write about 2 years in the life of a minor poet or something like this. And then only later, when they're almost retired, do they get to write the big book. I was fortunate that I got to go ahead to do this book in intellectual history and cultural history, but of course I was writing about new ideas within that intellectual history arena.
And of course the book does go back a long way. You are in fact talking about the book of Genesis, literally ancient history in the first chapters.
Yes, I found that I needed to extend that story. Initially I thought I could sort of tell the American story, and then I realized that we brought over a good deal of intellectual baggage to the New World, a good deal of which was weighed down with Judeo-Christian ideas about wilderness, about wild land, about civilization, and those things naturally fed into what we thought. So you couldn't just start the story in 1492 or 1620. You had to really pick up the European roots and the Old Testament roots, and the idea of wilderness was an extremely important one to the Judeo-Christian civilizations in the time of the Old Testament books, and you can go back there and find some extremely interesting biases and prejudices about wild country that stem from a herding and agriculture.
What is wilderness? Or perhaps, given what we've said, I should ask the question differently. What have people over the years thought wilderness is?
Well, the definition centers on perception, as I've been implying, as a state of mind. One person's wilderness may be another's roadside amusement park. It kind of depends on where you come from. But having said that there is a good deal of subjectivity in it, one thing that seems to stand out in wilderness is the lack of control, the lack of control that human civilization tries to place upon wild things, upon nature, domestication with animals, fencing, agriculture, cities, control in terms of land. And if you have something that is wild, it is beyond that control, and therefore requires a degree of human self-reliance, and therefore involves a certain amount of fear. And so, since the herding, gathering, hunting, and gathering culture was replaced agricultural one, we've had a considerable flip-flop on what people thought wilderness was. Initially, I don't believe they really conceived of wilderness. I don't think hunters and gatherers even thought about wild country as being wild, because it was nothing to compare it to. You understand, Fred? It was just simply a habitat. But as soon as you began to domesticate animals, control land, plant plants, do fields, do corrals, do city walls, then suddenly the environment that was on the outside became the wild place, and the place of wild beasts, or the land that was self-willed, which are two etymological approaches to the definition. Self-willed land, not will, not land, that is, being made to conform to human will.
One of the interesting things that you develop in your book is the way in which appreciation of wilderness and later protection of the wilderness evolves. Interestingly, those kinds of concerns arise not in the wild, but in the cities. They're the products, in the sense of urbanizing America.
Well, that's true. I've said that the wilderness movement is an urban phenomena, and the early advocates of wilderness were city people. The Sierra Club is a perfect example, begun in 1892 by John Muir, all of whom were rather sophisticated San Francisco Bay, Berkeley intellectuals, professors, People like to gather and talk and then go out and take outings into the wilderness. It was very hard to interest a pioneer, miner, or lumberman or trapper in wilderness preservation with the frontier biases. But when wilderness became a novelty, as it was in an urban situation, then increasingly it was looked upon as an asset rather than a liability. It's the old familiar scarcity theory of value. When you have a lot of something, it's not valued for very much, once we had a lot of wilderness. When you have less wilderness, then suddenly you begin to recognize its value and move toward protecting it, and that's, I think, what Americans began to do in the 1890s, which is a very pivotal period in this intellectual history of changing views of wilderness.
There are some who want to protect the wilderness for their own recreational purposes, but one of the people you devote a chapter to in Wilderness in the American Mind, Henry David Thoreau, went much farther than that. He said that in wilderness is the preservation of the world. What did he mean by that, and how should we understand his message in the 21st century?
That's a great quote by Thoreau from 1851. The actual quote was, in wildness is the preservation of the world, and he meant a quality of wildness, not just wilderness as a sense of land, but a quality of wildness in people as well as in land. And what Thoreau was getting at was that vitality, vigor, creativity derived from this wild and uncontrolled part of human nature and of actual nature, and if it was snuffed out, we lost, one might say, the cutting edge of our creativity and culture. And so the raw material of wilderness needed to be mixed a bit with the sands of civilization, as Thoreau pointed out, like fertilizer was mixed with potting soil. Too much, probably not a good thing, but too little, definitely not a good thing. And he pointed out to Rome and other nations that have declined and fallen because they got away from their wilderness roots. So Thoreau thought wilderness was essential to the human spirit and to the human intellect, and without it we withered and perished. I think since Thoreau's time, we've come to see wilderness as more important ecologically, not only as an ecological resource, as kind of an anchor to windward in these seas of ecological change, but also as what I call a moral resource, a place where we demonstrate our capacity to restrain ourselves, a moral resource, a spiritual resource, a place where we demonstrate that we are not owners of the earth, that we, after all, are team players, and we share the planet with other things. Good thing to think about on this Earth Day. And that meaning of wilderness only came after a long period of rather anthropocentric thinking, where wilderness was looked upon as just good scenery or recreation or having economic value as far as tourism goes.
One of the people you devote a chapter to in Wilderness in the American Mind also is Aldo Leopold, author of the Sand County Almanac. One of his essential points was that an ecological worldview ought to require a revolution in ethics, in philosophy, and also in history. I wonder if you were inspired either directly or indirectly by his example or his admonition.
Well, Leopold was of course, very important, not only in your part of the world, because he grew up down there and then later went to the University of Wisconsin, where I studied for my PhD. So when I came out, I immediately became interested in Leopold, found his papers, talked to his widow, organized his papers at the university archives, began to realize that this man was important and had been relatively neglected since the publication of that Sand County Almanac in 1949. And in that post-war period, people just didn't pay much attention to what Leopold was saying. He was talking about an ethical relationship toward the land. He was talking about an expansion of the moral community to include land and its component parts. This was an astonishing leap of ideas philosophically. And Leopold came at it as a scientist, but also as a philosopher. And we're beginning to find that his book, like the Quran or the Bible and many other important texts like that, can be taken by each succeeding generation, understood in little different ways, applied in different ways. There's a richness there. People can go back and find things in it. I think that's true of Leopold's work.
You've described another book of yours, The Rights of Nature, which appeared in 1989, as a kind of sequel to Wilderness in the American Mind. What is the connection between the two?
I do think it's a kind of a sequel. This is a University of Wisconsin Press book that appeared in 1989. It's been translated, by the way, into six languages, which is kind of interesting, because seems like people elsewhere are interested in that idea. Wilderness American Mind has been translated into a number of languages, too. But rights of nature particularly seems to interest people. What I was trying to do there was do the ecocentric case for protecting nature, talking about the anthropocentric reasons for it, which powered the wilderness movement for most of its history. You looked at, well, wilderness is valuable for us, humans, as a place to recreate, or as a place to see beautiful scenery, as a place to get religious ideas, or calm ourselves psychologically, or what have you. But it all came back to man was the measure. Humans were the measure of the thing. And what ecocentrism does is push that aside, begin to talk about things like the rights of nature, begin to recognize that wilderness may be a place where we express a certain planetary humility, when we restrain ourselves, where we allow other creatures and other processes to have their rightful place on the earth. Looked at that way, wilderness has a much deeper value. In fact, you don't even have to go to it for it to have value. Simply to have it there as a alternative to the land we control becomes extremely important. So I think, encouraged by Dave Foreman and some other friends to go a little bit beyond the anthropocentrism of Wilderness and American Mind, I started The Rights of Nature, which is not just about wilderness, but does interweave people like Thoreau and Leopold and Robert Marshall and John Muir.
It makes the point, of course, it may be one of the central points, that the circle of rights has been constantly expanding over time. White men with property, white men without property, nature has rights as well. Why does environmental history matter?
Why does environmental history
yes.
matter? Well, you know, everything is history, and if we don't remember the past, we're condemned to repeat it, it's been said. One can find from the past both examples of what to do and what not to do. And I'm kind of more inclined to look at the ones that inspire us showing us what to do. And that moral extension you just talked about is enormously significant and encouraging to me as an educator. That is, if you look back 300 or 400 years ago, the rights of women, let's say, Middle Ages, rights of women had no rights, really. They couldn't own property until 1875 in the United States. Now we're accustomed to think of women's rights. It's become absorbed into our culture. Many good things have derived from it. But it simply didn't exist in human culture for millions of years. We're now beginning to see changes in our attitudes toward various races, toward various sexual persuasions. These things are historical. We've seen a huge revolution in attitudes toward black people. Once they were slaves, property, owned, just as nature now is property, owned, some would say a slave, and just as there were certain conditions placed on slavery, now there have been some conditions placed upon how we use nature. We can use it, but we can't abuse it. If it's an endangered species involved, we have to back off, and so forth. This, to me, is an interesting parallel, an interesting trend that we can look back in history and say we've gone from natural rights, the Thomas Jeffersonian concept, we've gone from natural rights to the rights of nature. We're not there yet. We're not complete, but we're better than we have been.
We have only a short time remaining. In that minute or so, I wonder about the kind of history that you think historians ought to be doing. The history you've described, particularly the rights of nature, is in a sense, I think, a history of advocacy, a history that involves a certain degree of moral commitment. Is that how you understand history to be? Is that what historians should be doing?
Well, I think that the age of objectivity and the goal of objectivity is one that is now regarded as something of a dinosaur in scholarship. It seems to me that much more important than objectivity is passion. And I mentioned in the fourth edition of Wilderness, the American Mind, that I'm coming out of the closet of objectivity. I'm not going to pretend that I really don't care one way or the other about wilderness. I care a lot about wilderness. I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't care a lot about wilderness. And I think you can still be an excellent scholar. I don't think you have to have a concern for fudging evidence or for ignoring documents. But I think without that passion, we lack a dimension in scholarship. So I believe that we will find the best books in the future, like, say, Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac, or Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, or Thoreau's work, the best books will be those that are passionate about their subject.
Well, Professor Nash, thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Fred, it's a pleasure. Happy Earth Day to you.
And to you as well. I've been visiting with Roderick Nash, the author of Wilderness and the American Mind and the Rights of Nature.
For our site of the week, to complement our interview with Roderick Nash, we've chosen a little-known but excellent museum dedicated to the study of natural history, located in one of the nation's most exciting cities. Here to tell you about the museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Marjorie Barrick Museum of Natural History on the campus of the University of Las Vegas offers exhibitions that emphasize the native culture of the Southwest and Central Americas. The Mojave Desert region is filled with natural beauty and life, and you have a chance to see and understand the fragile ecosystem of the desert in several exhibits, some of it even featured in displays of live snakes, lizards, and desert tortoise. The beautiful carvings of the Hopi Indians, the dramatic weavings of the Navajo, and the survival arts of the Southern Paiutes are also featured throughout the museum, which was established in 1969. Exhibits on the early history of Las Vegas and the building of Hoover Dam are included as well. The museum also houses the Harry Reid Center for Environmental Studies.
PBS's American Experience series is highly regarded for its informative as well as entertaining representation of American history. Our guest this week, however, historian Nancy Younger, has some problems with the way a recent broadcast on Woodrow Wilson pictured the past.
Recently, PBS premiered a documentary biography about Woodrow Wilson. Like the vast majority of programs in the American Experience series, it was beautifully produced. Vivid photographs and footage were combined with informative and entertaining commentary by leading scholars. But, unfortunately, the final product often gave us history light, history reduced to the personal. Reducing history to personality distorts events and their significance. The presidential election of 1912, for example, was not, as American Experience would have it, a personality contest between former President Theodore Roosevelt, baby kisser and backslapper, and New Jersey Governor Woodrow Wilson, cool intellectual. It was instead a vitally important referendum on the ideas of profoundly thoughtful and intelligent men that would determine the course of the nation. To present Woodrow Wilson as little more than his prevailing character traits, scholarly, cerebral, yet passionate, is akin to presenting Abraham Lincoln as earthy, moody, and brilliant, with the Civil War merely as a colorful backdrop. It's like focusing on Osama bin Laden as a religious fanatic and barely mentioning global politics. Contrary to American Experience, Woodrow Wilson did not almost single-handedly invent progressivism. Instead, a variety of reformers began that complex series of programs. Wilson himself graciously acknowledged that many of his proposals were inspired by others, especially Wisconsin Senator Robert La Follette. Yet, on American Experience, even Theodore Roosevelt, far earlier on the reform scene than Wilson, and arguably the most influential progressive leader of them all, received little credit. He was described as a middle-of-the-road reformer, important principally for his hatred of Wilson. Their very divergent political and social visions were not addressed. By 1912, Roosevelt was calling for aggressive government action, including tax, labor, and campaign reform. Wilson considered direct federal involvement paternalistic and detrimental to free enterprise and open competition. He staunchly opposed the kind of interventionist government that Roosevelt was proposing. The differences between Roosevelt and Wilson over the proper role of government were so profound that they continue to resonate in today's partisan arguments. To present historical figures as essentially the sum total of their personality traits is contrary to reality and creates false expectations concerning current and future leaders. Just as in Wilson's day, major figures today, such as George W. Bush, Rudolph Giuliani, and Pakistan's president, General Parvez Musharraf, are complex people responding not only to private, but to local, national, and global influences. Because television can be a powerful tool in presenting the valuable lessons of the past and the present, it's all the more important that it gets its history right.
You've been listening to Nancy Unger, professor of history at Santa Clara University and the author of Fighting Bob La Follette, The Righteous Reformer. Nancy Unger's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. And finally, looking ahead to upcoming events of historical interest, we follow up on Nancy Unger's commentary by recommending to you another American Experience production, this one on Ulysses S. Grant. The two-part, four-hour documentary on the Union hero of the Civil War and American president will air on May 5th and 12th. During the Civil War, Grant's ruthlessness in battle won him the nickname Unconditional Surrender. His victories altered the course of the war and assured a Union victory. After the war, a grateful American public elected Grant president during one of the most tumultuous moments in American history. For 2 years, he struggled to define the meaning of the war he had fought so hard to win and the Union he struggled to preserve. The good news was that the Union had been preserved, says historian David Bradley. The bad news was that the Union had practically killed itself. Guys were coming home missing arms and legs. Lots of guys weren't coming home at all. It was a total mess. As if that wasn't enough, while President Grant confronted scandal and economic depression, neither of which may have been of his making, but that many believe he bungled. You decide. Tune in Ulysses S. Grant, another segment of PBS's American Experience on May 5th and 12th. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Laveau. Nature's waiting.